Welcome to Insight, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. A couple thousand Elk Grove Unified High School seniors are finding out that they qualify for guaranteed admission to Sacramento State. Ahead on Insight, we'll learn more about this new pilot program ahead of the May 1st application deadline. Also, the need for animal blood donations is on the rise. We'll learn about two programs at the UC Davis Veterinary Hospital, providing hundreds of animal transfusions every year, and how local dogs can do their part to support their canine peers. Finally, a free event at Sacramento City College this weekend will celebrate National Poetry Month and feature a U.S. Poet Laureate Emeritus. We'll get a preview of Power of the Word, an intergenerational conversation. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. First, here's the news. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. This spring semester has posed some extreme challenges for a lot of high school seniors hoping to attend college in the fall. One of the main issues that we have explored on Insight multiple times is the newly revamped federal financial aid program, FAFSA, which has delayed the application process for millions of students and their families. The big decision deadline is May 15th, and many students still don't know where they will go because they don't know if they can afford it. In addition to cost, some students are not applying to schools because perhaps they don't realize that they're actually eligible. Case in point, Elk Grove Unified School District, which is the largest district in our area, counselors there have identified more than 2,000 students who can get into Sacramento State but have yet to apply. The deadline for the upcoming fall semester is next week, May 1st. Now, Sacramento State and Elk Grove Unified have launched a pilot program offering guaranteed admission to those students. They just need to apply. Joining us is Brian Henley with the Director of Admissions and Outreach for Sacramento State, as well as Lori Gerber with Elk Grove Unified. Welcome to you both. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
All right, Lori. Well, I want to start with you. Elk Grove is the largest district in our area, one of the largest school districts in California. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the student population that you serve.
Yeah, so we are the fifth largest school district in California, and a lot of people don't realize just the span that we cover, right? So we're 320 square miles. So while we talk about this partnership with Sacramento State, the kids in Elk Grove greatly benefiting from that, we also have students in South Sacramento, Rancho Cordova. So this partnership really will branch out into a lot of different communities and also be able to impact a lot of students from different backgrounds that we serve.
Typically, how many seniors within your school district move on to a community college, a UC or a CSU?
I don't have the exact numbers on that, but I can tell you that just talking with counselors and visiting with some of our seniors as we've approached the end of the school year, a lot of our students do, right? So we have several community colleges in the area that they can access, and then also kids that are going to school both locally and out of state. So we do have students, a lot of students that are looking, but I will say, kind of building off of what you said there in the beginning, that we are noticing that a lot of kids haven't made decisions yet. They are waiting. You know, they're waiting for that financial aid. They're not sure what that's going to look like for them. So we have a lot of students right now that I think I could pretty confidently say are still waiting to make that decision.
Yeah, some people may be surprised. I was surprised to learn that there's more than 2,000 high school seniors who qualify to go to Sacramento State, just one of the CSUs in California, but have not applied yet. Do you have more information when you talk to counselors why that's happening?
You know, I don't have exact answers on that, but I can say then Brian can probably build on this a little bit. With this partnership, you look at, you know, what's being asked of the students, right? And on track to meet A through G requirements or have already met them, and a 2.5 GPA, you're looking at a wide range of students there that can really benefit from this.
How did this program, this pilot program, come about, Brian?
Thank you for having me, Vicki. We've got a new president at Sacramento State, President Luke Wood, and there are lots of new innovative initiatives that we're doing. This pilot program came about, honestly, as you all know, frequently formal relationships start with informal relationships, and it came about from a conversation with Nicole Brown, who's the lead district counselor for Elk Grove, and me after a meeting where we were. So I started talking with Nicole and working with the folks at Elk Grove, and like you mentioned, we identified these 2,000 students who were eligible for admission at Sacramento State but had not yet applied. One of the things that we think and that we know is that particularly students from low-income backgrounds who might be the first in their families to go to college, might not be aware of all of the opportunities that are available to them. So we just want to make sure that students who have a four-year university in their future and are eligible for that four-year university are aware of the fact that that opportunity is available to them.
How are you letting those students know that they're eligible?
Well, right now, the way that we're doing it is through our colleagues at Elk Grove. We've emailed the parents, or on our behalf, Elk Grove School District has emailed the parents, emailed the students, and let them know. We're also running some social media around that just to get the word out, and then doing things like this, talking with you on Insight, talking with the local media, getting things out through media releases and things like that.
When it comes to this really conditional guaranteed admission to Sacramento State, is this the first time Sac State is doing something like this, or is there something? Was there a framework to build off of?
This is the first time, but it's certainly not the last time. Sometimes I used to work with someone who said was fond of saying you can't start it done. So we started with Elk Grove. It made sense to start with Elk Grove. They're one of our largest feeder districts. They have a diverse student population, as do we. We wanted to start with a district that would sort of exercise the system a little bit without overwhelming the system. So it made sense to start with Elk Grove, but this is an initiative that we're going to have going with multiple school districts over the next few months and years.
Yeah, there's more than a dozen school districts in Sacramento County alone. I mean, there's six
exactly.
large ones here, so there's a lot to build off of. And I think about when talking with people who, you know, want to grow and diversify the economy in the greater Sacramento region, a big key piece of that is keeping college talent, keeping people who graduate from UC Davis or Sacramento State and keeping them local so that they contribute to the economy. I would imagine this helps as well because, you know, their family homes are, you know, 20-minute drive away.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. We think of ourselves as California's Capital University. We're the only public university in the fifth largest economy in the world, in the government of the capital of the fifth largest economy in the world. So we get students from all over the state, literally all over the world, but we do want to make sure that we're serving the students in our local area first, because as you mentioned, if they come to Sacramento State, have a great experience, get those internships here, in our local area, chances are they're going to stay and work and contribute to the local economy.
Lori, when it comes to Elk Grove Unified, logistically, what are they doing to let these students know that they can apply to Sacramento State and they're guaranteed admission for this coming fall?
Yeah, you know, like Brian said, we've done the emailing to parents, but also we've worked with our principals, counselors that are at each site, and then our college and career readiness staff to let students know, hey, look, if you've got these things lined up, this applies to you. So we've put that out there for all of them to share. We're also really encouraging our students to explore all those financial aid opportunities, both federal and state scholarships, all those things, because while this is a fantastic opportunity, there are going to be some financial challenges for some students. And there's a lot of assistance out there. So those resources are equally important to make sure that our students are aware of as they go into this next step.
Yeah, that's an important point, because although Cal States are considered, you know, one of the most affordable universities, especially when you compare it to UCs and private universities, I mean, tuition right now is $4,000 a year for a full-time student. That doesn't include any other campus expenses from books to food to housing. What options are available for these students if you're one of those 2,200 now learning that you can attend Sac State this fall? They say yes, but that's a lot of money for a lot of families. How do you help them navigate that financial process?
It is a lot of money for a lot of families, but also, as you mentioned, the tuition at a Cal State is still relatively low if you look nationwide. And we are fortunate in some ways to be in California that to a much larger degree than in a lot of other states, California still supports public education in in the state of California. So there are federal financial aid programs like the Pell Grant program. There are state grant programs like the Cal Grant. So the first thing that we encourage students to do is be sure that they've completed the free application for federal student aid if they're U.S. citizens and eligible to complete that application. If they are not U.S. citizens and are California residents, be sure that they're completing the California Dream Act application so that they can be eligible for all of the aid that's available. The deadline is coming up here pretty quickly to complete those applications. So students who are still in that, I'm not sure if I can afford it boat, and haven't completed those applications need to do that as quickly as they can.
Yeah, there's still time, but it is just right around the corner. May 1st is the deadline to apply at Sacramento State. That is next Wednesday, I believe. It's next week. But then also because of these FAFSA delays and challenges with this new rollout, the Cal State system also has extended when students can apply for financial aid, correct?
That's correct. May 1st. For our admission application, but students also need to complete their application for financial aid by May 1st, which is an extension of previous years too.
I talked to the Cal State Chancellor about this about a month or two ago when Mildred Garcia joined us about enrollment at Cal State universities. It's a challenge. It's not only isolated to Cal State universities, but it has been down roughly 6% system-wide. How has Sac State been impacted, and could pilots like this help turn that around?
I think it could. And to be honest, Sacramento State has not been affected as much as many of the other smaller Cal State campuses have. But it has given us an opportunity to look at some things that we haven't been able to do in the past. For example, we've only admitted upper division transfers recently. So those are students who have 60 units or more. In college, we're opening up to lower division transfer students at this point. So if a student started at a community college but feels ready to transfer, they're welcome to transfer to Sacramento State earlier than at that upper division level if they meet the requirements. And I think initiatives like the guaranteed admission initiatives like our new Black Honors College initiative. I think initiatives like our new Combat U initiative sets us up well to continue with that growth in enrollment that we've experienced over the last few years.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a new pilot program, a partnership between Sacramento State and Elk Grove Unified School District to offer eligible high school seniors guaranteed admission to Sacramento State if they apply by the May 1st deadline. We only have a few minutes left, but when it comes to that gap of students who are eligible to go to college but are not applying, is there a narrative out there that given the challenges and how costly college could be, that it's not financially in their best interest to go to college and perhaps go to a trade school? Are you hearing that among counselors when they're trying to talk to students to see what they want that next chapter of their lives to look like, Lori?
I think it's really on an individual basis. You know, I think it really just depends on the student, on the family, on what kind of financial aid is available. There's so many factors that I think it really is something that is very individual. We have a lot of great pathways in our district for students to take that route with trade schools and different things. So there are a lot of options. And for us as a district, we want, you know, our students to be successful at every level. And this partnership with Sacramento State, especially being with the local university, it's a win, right? It's a great opportunity for our students, our seniors, especially as they're getting ready to graduate, go off into the world, to have options. And we want them to have options. This is a fantastic one that keeps them close to home in the community. And like Brian said, possibly staying here and contributing after college as well.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, you are in admissions and outreach at Sacramento State. Is that something that you and your colleagues talk about the appetite for college for some students? Maybe it's just not there.
I think the appetite is not there. And I think it's a It's a factor of being able to appreciate some delayed gratification. We still see all the research indicates that someone who has a four-year degree versus just a high school diploma, while they might be able to go out and earn, you know, $20-$25 an hour immediately out of high school now, chances are 5-10 years down the road and over the course of their lifetime, they're going to earn somewhere in the neighborhood of $800,000 to $1 million more over the course of their lifetime than they would if they had just stopped with that high school diploma. So I think the point is do something after high school. If that's trade school and that's your path, that's wonderful. If it's a four-year degree and that's your path, that's also a wonderful option. Understand that the delayed gratification of being able to, if you can afford it and if you can swing it, get that four-year degree ultimately will pay off for you.
Given that you have your pulse on education and just overall higher education here in Sacramento, you know, the capital city of California, what does higher education look like to you maybe in the next decade as it continues to evolve?
I think one of the things that we're not going to be able to continue to concentrate on so much is that traditional 18 or 20-year-old high school recent graduate or transfer student. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 800,000 adults in the Sacramento region who have some college but no degree. And I think higher education in the future is going to look more like, how do we get those folks to come back and complete that degree so that they can reap the benefits of a four-year degree as well?
Lori, I'll leave the last word to you. I mean, if there are families listening to this, I mean, these are big decisions and costly decisions to make. What would you like them to know?
Well, I think the most important thing is to know that you have options. And with Elk Grove Unified, you know, we're really making it a point for our counselors and our principals and our staff and our college and career centers to make sure that students know what those options are and to be aware of the opportunities that are in front of you. With this partnership, it's a really great option for students who maybe just haven't figured it out yet. And just add it to your list as you're, you know, trying to figure out what you want to do when you graduate.
Lori and Brian, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
And that is Brian Henley, Director of Admissions and Outreach for Sacramento State. And Lori Gerber is with the Elk Grove Unified School District. They're just talking about a new pilot program, which is a partnership between the university and the school district, offering guaranteed admission to eligible high school seniors as long as they apply to Sac State by May 1st. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Many of us are familiar with donating blood, rolling up our sleeves at the blood bank or a donation center, but there is also a rising need for donations when it comes to animals. As veterinary science advances, two programs at UC Davis are hard at work to meet this need. The Transfusion Medicine Service is serving hundreds of animal patients each year, and for over a decade, the Canine Community Blood Donor Program has allowed dogs to help their canine peers. Joining us now is UC Davis professor Dr. Kate Farrell. She is the assistant director of the Blood Bank and Transfusion Medicine Service. Welcome. This was such a treat. I mean, I know that this program, the blood donor program for dogs, has been going on for over a decade, but I did not know that until I was preparing for this conversation. Before we dive into these two programs, can you first just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in working in veterinary medicine and animal care?
Sure, absolutely. Honestly, my interest in veterinary medicine has been for quite some time. My first word was the name of our family dog, and not mom or dad. That built a long history of interest in animals, and that interest only grew over time. I really became interested in emergency and critical care medicine through vet school and subsequent to that. And so now I have specialized in emergency and critical care medicine in small animals, which is dogs and cats. And so within that field, of course, occasionally there are needs for our really sick patients with a wide variety of diseases to need transfusion products, just like people do sometimes. And so that's also how I got into kind of a transfusion medicine and blood banking interest as well.
If someone doesn't know what transfusion medicine is, what is it?
Sure. Great question. Just like humans, as you kind of mentioned in the beginning, just like people can donate blood, our pets can donate blood as well. So any species that we regularly deal with in the hospital has the potential to donate blood and give that blood to another animal if they need it. So sometimes that's the red blood cells in blood that patients need. Sometimes that's other components of blood, various proteins and coagulation factors in plasma or platelets, which are necessary for clotting. So a wide variety of needs that another patient might need blood products from another patient.
How long has transfusion medicine for animals in veterinary care, how long has it been around?
Yeah, great question. I mean, realistically, for hundreds of years, but in terms of its much more specialized form, really, blood banking and transfusion medicine services in veterinary medicine have really developed over the past sort of couple of decades, and we're able to provide much more specialized services, much more specialized sort of blood products to patients to serve a variety of needs.
I know that the veterinary school and the hospital at UC Davis is like a leader in the world. I mean, how large is your blood bank and your blood donor program when compared to other places in the state?
Yeah, great question. We have had sort of the largest community canine blood donor program in the state. Certainly, our hospital in general provides blood products to a huge variety of animals. You know, each year we're providing hundreds of transfusions to a wide variety of patients. You know, probably the majority of those are dogs, cats, and horses, but we also provide transfusions, blood products to cows, goats, sheep, llamas, donkeys, pigs. So a wide variety of species that we're able to provide for.
I would imagine that animals have blood types like people, like humans, and we all have different blood types.
You're exactly right. So just like people, every species has blood types that are unique to that species. So dog blood types are different from people blood types. Cat blood types are different. Horse blood types are different. There's a huge variety of species where we don't really know their blood types. A lot of exotic animal species.
So what do you do then? Has a circumstance, a situation ever came up where you had an animal you needed to care for, but you didn't have their specific blood?
Absolutely, absolutely. So honestly, for a wide variety of patients, so many exotic animals and even our livestock who we do know quite a bit about their blood types. Most of the time, we can get away with transfusions from a similar, same species, similar type of animal. So for instance, let's say we need to provide a transfusion for a specific type of rabbit. We look for the closest species sort of relative possible. Usually that allows us to get away with a safe transfusion. Fortunately, most species, there's a few exceptions, but most species don't have these sort of circulating pre-existing antibodies that have the potential to lead to a transfusion reaction on a first transfusion. So we're able to get away with it with closely related blood for most species.
I would imagine when you talk about exotic animals or wildlife, if you come encounter with them, that would be tough to find a blood donor, because it's not like, for example, a dog with an owner. You're bringing it in and you're getting their sample.
Yeah, for sure. You know, sometimes when we have situations, let's say we have, our team has a exotic bird. Many times owners have two birds of that species. And so we sort of go to that, as a resource first, as a potential. But sometimes there are situations where, you know, we don't have an option for blood from the same species. So, you know, we had a bobcat relatively recently in our intensive care unit, and we had to kind of debate between dog blood, cat blood, and sort of choose the best option for that animal based on the testing we could provide.
When an animal is receiving a blood transfusion, I mean, what are some of the typical reasons for that?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, just like people, there can be a wide variety of diseases that end up affecting animals. Anemia, which is a low red blood cell quantity, can happen for a wide variety of reasons. So, you know, patients who have experienced a traumatic accident or are bleeding for another reason, or maybe their bone marrow is not doing a good job of producing cells appropriately. All of those mean we might need to replace red blood cells in a patient. And then other components of blood. So, you know, sometimes there's immune disorders that result in destruction of red cells or platelets in the body. And so sometimes we need to replace those. Sometimes animals can have coagulation disorders that can result from a variety of underlying disease processes, whether that's toxins or underlying organ problems. And so all those different components of blood we're able to replace in an animal if we need them.
When I've donated blood, I mean, there are different options of what you can donate. I would think that that's the same for animals as well, that you provide a variety of blood products.
Yeah, absolutely. So in general, most of the time when we're talking about a blood donation, that's whole blood. So for instance, we have a dog come in, donates whole blood, and then usually we process that into different components. So we will generally process that into red blood cells, plasma, and sometimes platelets. And that really allows us to give sort of specific products that are needed for a patient, allows us to, you know, have that whole blood donation go as far as possible. So utilizes our resources as best as possible and means we're not giving blood components that a patient doesn't need.
Mm. I also think in recent years, or maybe over the past few decades, you know, the reasons for taking a pet to the vet have grown. I think it's increasingly more common to take your pet or even a livestock animal for veterinary care. And I would think because that demand is there and that need is there from the owner standpoint, that probably is just great momentum for this field to continue to evolve at places like UC Davis.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Certainly we have seen that trend in a wide variety of areas in emergency and critical care. As you know, as we can provide more in veterinary medicine, just like as the human medicine field advances, veterinary medicine advances, and pet owners, you know, want to be able to do everything to provide for their pets. And so these, you know, specialized products and you know, our transfusion service, as it grows as well, is really able to provide sort of the best in critical care for our patient population.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Kate Farrell from the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine about their animal transfusion service and their blood bank for a variety of pets and livestock. Okay, so let's hone into the Canine Community Blood Donor Program. People may be learning about this for the first time. How long has this been around?
Yeah, good question. We started storing and sort of having a blood bank and a community blood donor program for a bit over a decade now, I think about 2008. And so that has really evolved over time. We have a very large community canine blood donor program now, which has been a wonderful resource, of course, for our patients who need blood products, as well as, you know, a lot of benefits that it actually provides for our blood donors as well.
How many doggy donors do you have?
Yeah, so we at any given time, we have about 80 to 90 doggy blood donors in our program who sort of rotate through and provide blood donations for us.
So if you end up taking your dog, you know, to donate blood, help us visualize what the process is like when they enter your facility.
Sure. So our blood banking team and our nurses who are responsible for the vast majority of our blood donations are incredible. They really help make our dogs feel comfortable. There's lots of positive reinforcement, lots of great training. And so our dog donors who come in, sit for a blood donation, they're very comfortable. There's no sedation we ever use or is required. And it's a very short process. Honestly, it only takes a handful of minutes for a blood donation. And then patients can go on their way. There's no other sort of major requirements for them. But there's a lot of benefits for them as well. They, not only are they getting sort of yearly physical exams to make sure they're really healthy, but they're getting yearly free blood work for them, make sure, you know, all of their sort of underlying health is good, lots of infectious disease testing to make sure they're healthy, and our blood products are, of course, safe for recipients. And, they get all sorts of positive reinforcement treats, goodie bags, things like that, as well as free, flea, tick, and heartworm prevention. So lots of great benefits for those blood donor dogs and their families.
Yeah, I mean, first off, that is very altruistic to do that. But also, that's a great perk to have in return, because vet care can be expensive. So if that includes free examinations, blood work, even those treatments. And you said treats. Is there a puppuccino like at the end of the donor? I would imagine they get a good amount of treats for their donation.
Yeah, totally. They get lots of good high value treats. We want them to be happy and satisfied to be there. So they get lots of treats and get to go home with treats as well. So certainly for them, we really ensure that those blood donors are happy and healthy. And if they ever do need it during their lifetimes as well, they have, free blood products for themselves for their lifetime. So they're very well taken care of and provide an incredible service. I mean, they're really heroes for our patient population. So it's sort of a win-win all around.
Yeah. We're talking about dogs. Is there a community blood donor program for other animals, like cats?
Yeah, that's a great question. So currently the main community blood donor program we run is a dog program. Cats are just a little bit trickier in terms of a variety of things, logistics, getting them into the hospital. They're usually a little less amenable.
My cat Chester is very sweet until he steps into a vet.
Yep, 100%. So
not a fan.
Yep. So it's occasionally just a little harder to facilitate that. There's a few more infectious disease testing concerns that make it a little bit trickier. Certainly, there are other people who have some community cats who do that, but at the moment we sort of focus on a community dog blood donor program. But we do have, on campus a variety of horses, cows, goats, other species that we have sort of readily available, so we can have blood products for a variety of animals.
Yeah, and I know that you treat, like you said, a variety of animals, but if cats are tricky when it comes to blood donations, I would imagine that could be tricky with transfusions as well. If a cat needs blood, how do you guys troubleshoot that?
Yeah. So, you know, certainly we provide a lot of transfusions to cats in the hospital as well. And that's where I get to see, you know, the other end of things in my emergency and critical care sort of roles. You know, many times there are patients who are more or less happy to be in a hospital. But sometimes the ones who need blood products are also a little bit sicker and a little bit more compliant. And obviously we want them feeling their sort of best by the end of their stay. And so, you know, most of the time, whether that is sort of careful handling, whether that's a little bit of an anti-anxiety medication, we have, you know, a variety of ways to, of course, help our patients feel comfortable there.
Are there certain types of blood for canines, since that's what the community blood donor bank is for, that you need that is in more demand? I know for humans, when I go to the blood bank, you know, there's sometimes a certain type of blood that is in high need.
Yeah, good question. So there are about 13 different sort of recognized blood types in dogs, but sort of one that's really important to us and that matters most for sort of safety of transfusions, and that's sort of type 1, dog erythrocyte antigen, or DEA1. And so dogs that are negative for that blood group are a little bit easier to transfuse to other patients and are sort of considered, you know, not quite, but sort of considered universal donors. So so for patients who are negative for that blood type, we try to get them in a little bit more frequently.
If you know the breed of your dog, does that give you an inkling, or can you look up what their blood type would be? I mean, how could you figure that out?
Yeah, good question. So to know blood types for sure, we have to test. And so that's just a very simple blood test. But there are breed predispositions in terms of blood types. So, for instance, boxers, the vast majority, over I think 90% of boxers, are DEA1 negative blood type. And so boxers are a great breed to come in, and we obviously want to make sure we know their blood type, so we always test them, but are more likely to be of the blood type that we need a little bit more.
So if you're listening to this, you have a dog, maybe you want them to become a donor, what do they need to know to see if their dog is eligible?
Great question. So for our doggy donors, of course, we want them to be in good health. We are doing physical exams and lots of testing to make sure, you know, to help ensure that they're healthy. But in general, we're looking for dogs that are between 1 and 8 years old. And are in good health, usually not, you know, usually of a sort of friendly temperament, and are over 55 pounds. So big enough to be able to kind of donate enough blood.
Okay. So it couldn't be a little dog.
Yeah. My little terrier can't be a donor as much as I would love for him to be.
Finally, how can owners get in contact if they think they might need a transfusion or any of these services, even the donor program?
Yeah, our donor program, we schedule through our main hospital number. If that's helpful, I can list that number, or we can put it up on our on the website.
I'm pretty sure we have it on our Insight page, so you don't have, but you can if you want.
Well, our main hospital number is 530-752-1393, and that anyone can call in there, one, to make a donor appointment, to see if they're eligible, to see if their dog is sort of, in a good position to do that. Certainly also for veterinary care, too. If patients have any sorts of needs across species, across, services in our hospital, you can always call that number to talk about care, or your veterinarian can give us a call also to talk about care.
Well, Dr. Farrell, thank you so much for joining us. Interesting.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity to chat.
I learned something new. Dr. Kate Farrell is a professor at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. We've been talking about their animal transfusion service and their community blood bank for a variety of pets and livestock, and how dog owners can get involved as blood donors. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Sacramento Poetry Center has been celebrating National Poetry Month through April, and this weekend, Sacramento City College will feature U.S. Poet Laureate Emeritus Juan Felipe Herrera for an event titled Power of the Word, an intergenerational conversation. The event is free, and it's happening this Sunday, April 28th at 1 p.m. at the Performing Arts Center at Sac City College. Joining us now is the event organizer Juan Manuel Carrillo and Patrick Grizel, the president of the Sacramento Poetry Center. Welcome to you both. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Ricky,
for having us.
So Juan, I want to start with you because you organized this event, which is going to happen on Sunday. How far back does your connection to the arts in Sacramento go?
Well, my entire time in Sacramento, actually. When I arrived in 1969, I arrived at the same time that Jose Montoya and Esteban Villa, two art, became faculty members of Sac State. And from that grew the Royal Chicano Air Force, which was a collective of artists, students, other faculty, on and on and on. The circle just grew. So that my entire 50-plus years here has been in the arts.
Why do you think the arts in Sacramento has been a part of your life for 50-plus years?
Simply put, because the community needs it, wants it, and grows from it. There's great things that come out of a community that participates in the arts, not just making it, but supporting it, attending events. It's very important to the to all of us, to the community.
What is your connection to the Sacramento Poetry Center?
Well, I was walking down the street one day. Anyway, I was asked,
Patrick.
I was asked to be an advisor to the board because I come out of arts administration. I worked for the State Arts Council as a career. And I don't know if that's why, but Patrick asked that I participate. So this past year I've been closer to the Poetry Center. But I've always known about the Sacramento Poetry Center as a funder when the state used to fund the Poetry Center.
Well, let's get to the event on Sunday. It is called Power of the Word. What inspired this event?
Well, again, Patrick asked, because I was part of the Royal Chicano Air Force, the RCIF, if there wouldn't be an occasion during the month that the RCIF would do something. And so I, what came out of that kind of conversation was, what do you say I call Juan Felipe Herrera, who I've known for 50 years, and see if he wouldn't come to Sacramento? And I called him and he said, sure. It's just a phone call. That's what made it happen. But we didn't want, in thinking about it, him speaking for an hour and a half on the stage reading poetry, this was an opportunity for us to invite a younger writer. And we chose Maceo Montoya, that other writer, to sit and have a conversation, in addition to reading their work, a conversation about writing. And so gravitated towards the power of the word.
I would imagine, Patrick, since the Sacramento Poetry Center has been putting on events all month for National Poetry Month, this must be a pretty big treat to have a U.S. Poet Laureate Emeritus at Sac City College this weekend.
It definitely is. We're calling it our keynote event, which of course it is. And part of that is just based on his position in poetry. You know, having a United States Poet Laureate is pretty significant. We also have the California Poet Laureate Lee Herrick coming this week as well. So it's almost like it's been building in that regard. But I mean, you know, Juan Felipe is part of the group of people that we've admired, we being members of the literary community in Sacramento, have admired for a very long time, and was connected to Jose Montoya, who Juan mentioned, you know, who was a friend and a mentor and also at a point an advisor for the Poetry Center and did a lot for us through the years. So that connection and the connection with Chicano artists in general has been a real significant piece of our history for a long time.
Jose was the Poet Laureate of Sacramento at one time.
Wow. Yes. And okay, and then when you mentioned, I mean, you mentioned two Montoyas. Maceo Montoya is going to be at the event on Sunday. Are the two related as well?
Mm-hmm. They are. The Montoyas are a force to be reckoned with. He's the nephew. Maceo's the nephew of Jose, but Maceo's father, Malaquias Montoya, is a heralded printer, painter, and Maceo is also a painter and a novelist, a writer. So he comes, and his cousins are very active and very creative. Tomas Montoya, his cousin, is a videographer, he's a poet, he's a painter as well. Other Montoyas, I could go on and on about the Montoyas, but yes, it is part of the family.
I mean, just learning that right now, as well as your connection to Juan Felipe Herrero goes back decades, and also that you're part of the Royal Chicano Collective here in Sacramento as well. I mean, Chicano arts, it seems like, is a very tight-knit community here in Sacramento and goes back generations.
It does. It does. Let me add one thing, if I can. I don't. You'll have to guide
Please.
Me on the time that we have here. But this is going to be a moderated conversation. Mm-hmm. And the moderator is Teresita Romo. Teresita has been part of the RCAF, and she at one time was the director of the La Raza Galería Posada. And she is a curator and has done some extraordinary work as a curator. But she is now on board with the Crocker to do an exhibition on the RCAF work in 2026. So we're all keeping our fingers crossed that we're going to be around in 2026.
Yeah. Oh, well, I hope so. I mean, this formed in 1970, correct?
Yes.
The Royal Chicano Air Force. Where did the name come from?
Well, there was a term that was used a lot, art front. Bay Area and other, and fronts were also very political, very revolutionary in Latin America. There would be all kinds of frentes, de liberación, anyway, so art front. So we were the Rebel Chicano Art Front, RCAF, and one day somebody said, looking at the name or a bag or something, and said, "Are you the Royal Canadian Air Force?" And our humor, the response was, "No, we're the Royal Chicano Air Force," and it stuck. It just, given the humor of the RCAF, that was more appropriate.
That is, that is a great story, yeah. And now I know. Now I know why it is called the Royal Chicano Air Force. Right. So for those, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are excited and interested in attending on Sunday. It's wonderful that it's free to the public. What would you like them to know to prepare?
Well, I think in terms of the audience that would want to hear him, we just want them to know that he will be there. It's happening. It's accessible. It's free, first of all. I think in terms of an opportunity to hear someone of his stature, which is infrequent, and being able to find a seat in the room, you know, first of all, show up a little early so that you can get there.
Yeah.
It will be a memorable experience for anyone who comes. And the people who are also participating, Maceo and Teddy Romo, will add a tremendous amount to that experience in dialogue.
I would suggest to anybody who doesn't know Maceo that, but he's local. He lives in Woodland and he teaches at UC Davis in the English department and the Chicano Studies department. But I've read several of his books. I'm reading The Scoundrel and the Optimist right now. He makes me laugh. He's a very serious man, but his writing, reminds me when I was young and I read Catch 22, if anyone ever remembers that book, mm-hmm. I would laugh silently by myself. I'd be reading the book and I'd laugh out loud. It's that kind of humor. But he's not a loco. I mean, he's a serious man. But when he starts writing, this humor just... So it'll be fun to watch these two. And they know each other. But to watch and listen to these two talk about their work, their history, their activism, it's going to be I'd say come early, stay late.
So. I would imagine that's where the part of the title is an intergenerational conversation. That's where the intergenerational component comes in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's those three people are up for the task, the moderator and the two artists. It should be wonderful.
Well, Patrick and Juan Manuel, thank you so much for joining us. It's going to be a great event.
Yes.
It will be a great event. I'll look for you in the audience.
Thank you.
And there are also events all week. I'll say very quickly, if people want to know other things that are happening, go to our website, sacpoetrycenter.org/poetrymonth, and the whole schedule is there.
And we also have that link on our Insight page, because wonderful. I scrolled through. You have lots of events happening this month.
Yeah.
Patrick Rizal is the president of the Sacramento Poetry Center, and Juan Manuel Carrillo is the organizer of an event titled Power of the Word, an Intergenerational Conversation, and it is featuring U.S. Poet Laureate Emeritus Juan Felipe Herrera. The event is free, and it's happening this Sunday, April 28th at 1 p.m. at the Performing Arts Center at Sac City College. We have more information on our Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests and conversations at capradio.org/insight. You can subscribe to the Insight podcast, or you can reach out to us by emailing us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great Monday. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.